a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is a-coming. Tell you why. Better world is a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is a-coming, don't you see?
Good morning and welcome to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, and today I'm welcoming our guest, Ms. Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, it's our honor to have you with us. You are doing such a great service for American consumers, and let's hope that more of them get a chance to profit from your wisdom. Winona, why don't you tell us what's going on right now? What's some of the latest news on the basically the centralized control of all food sources for American consumers?
Well, you know, we have only 20 food processing companies that control most of the brands in the grocery store. So Americans go into the store and they think they have a lot of choice and a lot of diversity. But really, there are just these few companies that now have so much political power that they are really able to dictate almost everything about our food system. And I think we're seeing a lot of the impacts of that today. For instance, poultry. Tyson is the fourth largest food processing company in the country, and the giant Brazilian meat company JBS is the fifth largest processing company in the country. They own brands like Pilgrim's Pride and Swift. And these companies have been able to use their political power to attempt to get the USDA to allow chickens to be slaughtered at 175 birds per minute. And that means that the slaughter lines move so quickly that a lot of the fecal matter gets on the carcass of the bird. And then the companies dip the carcasses in chlorine solutions and trisodium phosphate to kill the bacteria. I don't think most Americans want to eat fecal matter, even if the even if it's not going to poison them. And of course, sometimes the bacteria does remain on the meat, and people do get sick.
You know, I never noticed that on the labels, dipped in chlorine and trisodium phosphate, now with fecal material.
And that's right. You know, that is not on the label. And one of the interesting things about poultry is, really, since the late 1970s, the poultry industry has been able to have weight in their meat. So they're able to keep that water content in the meat. So the consumer is actually paying for the pleasure of having some of that chlorine or trisodium phosphate wash in the poultry that they're eating.
Since so many of us are let's be generous and say, a little skeptical about the FDA's scrutiny and the quality of their oversight, could you talk about that? Could you talk about what's going on with the FDA? Are they enforcing? Are they backing off? So many times we hear about environmental regulations being basically, you know, look the other way.
Right. Well, we have two agencies that are in charge of protecting Americans from food safety disasters. The first is the USDA that does the inspection around meat products, and then the FDA does the inspection around all other foods. And so what we've seen is that in the USDA, they are actually trying to hold back the meat inspectors from doing a thorough job in inspecting meat products. And over, really, it started with the Clinton administration, where they privatized inspection in processing, and now they're trying to allow meat companies to do self-inspection in the slaughter step as well. And the meat companies have an enormous amount of political power, and they're able to put a lot of pressure on the USDA. And so the agency, rather than giving the scrutiny to these huge processing plants where most meat is produced, it's a lot easier to pick on the smaller processing plants. And I think that's one of the problems that we see. Now, at the FDA, they have even fewer inspectors than at the USDA, and less than 1% of meat or of food products coming in from overseas, for instance, actually get an inspection. And one of the major problems that we have today is that so much of our food is imported because of the trade agreements and because the food processing companies want to produce food products where it's cheapest, where labor is cheaper. So especially produce and processed food is coming in from overseas. Even China has become a major importer into the United States of food products. For processed fruits and vegetables, they're about the largest or third largest importer today. So the fact that we have very weak regulations and not enough inspectors at the FDA is really affecting our food system. And you may remember a couple years ago, there was a Food Safety Modernization Act that was passed, and those rules are still being finalized. And actually, this week, the FDA is coming out with a suggested a rule around imported food. I think it came out today, and it's hundreds of pages long. Now, we're just taking a look at it today, but even if the rule actually is strict, which I doubt, we're not going to have enough inspectors to actually enforce it, and it won't be enforced. And so I think Americans should be very concerned about imported food and the fact that there's a trade agreement that's being negotiated now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that will allow even more favorable conditions for importing more food.
Can I ask you a question while we're talking about China just for a second? And it may very well be that you don't follow this particular issue. We heard some time ago about, was it hundreds or thousands of hogs being found in a river in China? Did you ever hear of what the impetus for that was? What were they poisoned by? And should we expect that pork to be shipped to the United States?
Well, I do know about the incident, and as far as I know, we never heard what caused the death of those hogs. But we do know that a major merger is going on today where the largest hog company in China is purchasing Smithfield, and that merger does not bode well for consumers.
You have a wonderful book, Foodopoly, that's to help inform consumers about the issues around food safety. Why don't you talk about Foodopoly?
Well, I wrote Foodopoly because I think that there just is not enough information about why people should be concerned with how the food industry has been concentrated in the hands of just a few companies. Decisions were made after World War II that there were too many farmers and that really food production should be vertically integrated and that it was more efficient to allow capital to replace labor, and the chemicals could replace labor. And so a number of policy decisions were made over a 40-year period that have resulted in this consolidation that we have today. And it really speeded up in the early 1980s when the Reagan administration came into office and eviscerated our antitrust laws. And then the Clinton administration also helped this consolidation along by supporting the trade liberalization and the continued deregulation. And so we're left now with these few companies that are so large and have so much political power that they are just able to dictate everything about our food system. And I think if we're really going to change this, people have to understand that these problems are deeper than subsidies or that we're going to be able to fix them with one farm bill. This is really about understanding what's happened to our democracy and trying to take back control of it, because I think this monopolization has also had an effect on our economy and really is the root of a lot of problems that we see across the board today, with a lack of jobs, to the stark difference between the very wealthy and the declining middle class, and also, of course, about our food system that is pretty much dysfunctional. And Foodopoly tells the story, and I try to tell it in a way that makes it interesting and that also gives people hope that we can actually do something about it.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned in the there's a wonderful video on the Foodopoly page. It talks about not just the vertical integration of these large companies, these agribusiness companies, but also how they're tied into the banking system and the investment houses as well. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, that's right. You know, what's really of concern is that these companies are, well, they're tied together in a lot of different ways. One of the pieces of research I did in putting together Foodopoly was looking, for instance, at how they have interlocking boards. And they, in board meetings, we have financial service companies, oil companies, chemical companies. We really see that these companies are linked together, and that's one of the problems that I think that we're seeing today. You know, I think it's really noteworthy that these interlocking directorates have they play a real decision-making role in multiple venues. There was a recent global corporate control study that noted that firms exert control over other companies via this web of direct and indirect ownership relations. And these boards bring together individuals that have this common economic interest. And I think that the financial services industry is especially powerful in these board relationships. You know, the past few decades where we've seen all of these mergers, acquisitions, and corporate takeovers, this wouldn't have been possible if the Wall Street firms that put the deals together didn't actually finance them and benefit from them. And so investment banks play a lot of roles in the food industry. They advise the companies in how to structure these mergers and acquisitions. They provide the access to capital. They lend companies cash to finance takeovers. And, you know, you can look at what's happened. A good example is in 2010 and 2011, we know that the food industry issued more than $60 billion in new corporate bonds to raise revenue either for takeover bids or to expand their businesses. And these financial firms actually help the food companies make the initial public offerings, and they encourage them to become public because this is where they make a lot of money. And, you know, it's the banks, it's the private equity funds, it's the law firms that earn the fees. And so really these food companies aren't viewed by Wall Street as providing a basic necessity like food. Food has become basically money.
One of the things that seems to also come into play with the sequestering, the deregulation fever that seems to have struck so many on the conservative side of the table, let's say, we've seen a rise in citizen journalism, but it seems that Big Ag has a response to citizen journalism, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. We've seen across the country that ALEC, which is the right-wing association that helps promote their agenda at state legislatures, they came up with a model piece of legislation that has resulted in what we call ag-gag laws, and they... this legislation is directed at individuals, activists who go out and take pictures of the pollution from factory farms or who go into slaughter facilities and show the abuse that's going on there. And this legislation is directed at preventing these activities. And more than 20 states have considered these ag-gag laws, which we believe in the long term should not stand up in court.
You know, we find ourselves in a situation where consumers are increasingly more conscious about what they eat and what the status of the food they eat. And I think your book, Foodopoly, does a great deal toward helping them understand the underlying structural issues that are essentially tainting the food supply. Could you talk just a little bit about your work with Food and Water Watch?
Yes. Food and Water Watch is a consumer advocacy group that's a little different than most public interest organizations. We really believe that it's a grassroots uprising that's going to be able to take back our democracy, and that we really need to involve large numbers of people in the political system, because it's great if we vote with our fork. We should vote with our fork. We need to vote with our vote. And then we need to hold the elected officials accountable. And to do that is going to take many, many people being involved. So we've put our resources into state offices where we can work with grassroots organizations and individuals to try to impact state regulation and laws, because one of the things that we see is that Congress has become so dysfunctional because of what's happened at the state level. We really need to link the issues that people are interested in with what state legislators are doing, because when you get state legislators elected who don't represent the views of their constituents, you end up with the situation that we have in Congress today, because every 10 years the state legislatures do the redistricting and they can gerrymander a state so that they can elect the kind of candidates that have the set of values and beliefs that they want. And so in any number of states, we're seeing people sent to Congress who don't really represent their constituents or the beliefs of most Americans.
I was looking at your website, the foodandwaterwatch.org, and there are some just tremendous tools there and resources, documents on tap water safety and smart seafood and the Global Grocer and Metrix and access to films and a water forum, what you can do about trichosan and the story of bottled water. These are just tremendous resources. I hope that from your book of Foodopoly, more people will be familiar with these resources that you bring and make available. I think it's tremendous.
We really hope so, because, you know, we have to all work together to really reclaim our democracy and to have the kind of world that we want. And I think that one of the ways that people can become informed is through websites like Food and Water Watch. And what we do at Food and Water Watch is we believe that, yes, we have to become informed and educated, but then we need to be able to take action. And we try to give people an avenue to take action that is meaningful and that is respectful of their time. So no matter how busy you are, there's something that you can do. And on our website, there's a way to join our listservs. You can take action on these important types of public policies that are being debated and stay informed about them. And if you have time to become more involved, there are ways that you can work on a deeper level with us. So I urge everybody to go to our website. In fact, we would love you to become a member of Food and Water Watch. And, you know, our website at foodandwaterwatch.org has a lot of information about the things that we're talking about today.
I'm sure that you folks, the Food and Water Watch, has not only a reach out to consumers, but has a reach out to some members of Congress that might actually be attentive to real-world concerns about food safety. Although I can see in some of what we might call the more agricultural-based states, big business probably has its tentacles around their wallets. And are there anybody in Congress who's been supportive and attentive to Food and Water Watch's issues?
Well, you know, I think that we have legislators around the country who, if their constituents put enough pressure on them, that they react. Now, of course, there are always some champions like Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro in New Jersey, like Senator Tester in Montana, who's done so much on some of the issues related to consolidation and genetic engineering. And, I think that what we need to do in every state is to really learn to know our legislators and to work with other citizens to try to make it possible for those legislators to take the stand that they should, because that really takes not only putting pressure on them, but organizing other people to also be aware of what's going on. And the way that our political system works today, where we basically have this system of legalized bribery, we're really in a position where we have to make our legislators do the right thing. They have to see that they have no other choice if they want to be reelected.
Well, Ms. Howder, where could people find your book, Foodopoly?
Well, they can go to the foodopoly.org website and see the list of places. They can go to any independent bookstore. Even Barnes & Noble is carrying Foodopoly or can order it. And then, of course, there is Amazon for those people who read on Kindle.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I certainly appreciate your time, and I wish you the best of luck. Are you coming to Florida anytime soon?
Well, I'm sure I'll be back in the next year, but I don't have any plans in the next few months.
Okay.
But I'll look forward to it, because I've had some great book events in Florida, and I always love to come and visit your beautiful state.
Well, thanks again, and we wish you the best of luck and every success.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Miss Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly, executive director of Food and Water Watch. I'm going to go to a little bit of music, and then we should be back in just a minute with executive director of PEER. And stay tuned. Here we go.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. What I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Now I don't want your Rolls Royce, mister. I don't want your pleasure yacht. All I want, just food for my baby, is to me my old job back. We work to build this country, mister, while you enjoyed a life of you've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children starve and freeze. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back.
If you wish, mister, call me green or blue or red. This one thing I sure know, mister, my hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No difference in them I can see, but with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister.
Was I Don't Want Your Millions, Mister, a wonderful song by the Almanac Singers. We're expecting Mr. Roche in just a minute, so stick around. Time for another tune. This is along the lines of protecting Mother Nature. This is called Nature's Way.
Nature's way.
While we're waiting for Mr. Rook, we're going to go ahead and do a news story. This is come as a shock to all of you, I'm sure. Halliburton pleads guilty to destroying evidence after the Gulf spill. And when you hear the back-breaking fine that these people will be charged with, you'll be amazed. Halliburton has agreed to plead guilty to destruction of critical evidence after the Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010, the Justice Department announced yesterday. Oil service company said it will pay the maximum allowable fine of, you better sit down, $200,000 and be subject to 3 years of probation. It won't even be able to take the car out on Saturday nights. It'll also continue cooperation. they actually do say it will continue its cooperation in the government's criminal investigation. Separately, Halliburton made a voluntary contribution of $55 million to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Okay, let's see. The fine for destroying documents for a cover-up was $200,000, and they're going to pay? I get it. Yeah, but they'll be paying $55 million to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. You think $200,000 fine is going to make them change their ways? Oh, I know. I'm counting on it. Oh, God, yes. I am definitely counting on it. Halliburton has suffered enormous damage to its crappy reputation, as have BP and Transocean. And we'll just have to fine them maybe $50,000 or something. My God, it's incredible. Well, ladies and gentlemen, enough of that PR release from the good people at Halliburton, who we know are just embarrassed, you know, and we'll just pay that fine. I'd like to introduce Mr. Jeff Rausch, Rook, who has been executive director of PIER since 1997. With Jeff DeBonis, he helped start PIER and for the first 4 years served as general counsel and program director. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome Mr. Rooks. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good, sir. Very good. And yourself?
I'm great.
Oh, that's great. One of the questions I like to ask my guests is, you know, clearly you're a person who has dedicated your life and your career to helping get the word out, helping whistleblowers get their information out. Clearly you're a person who's dedicated your life to seeing that the truth will out. Can I ask you a little bit about yourself? What in your background, what in your growth experience made you be a person who really wants to contribute over and above the call of duty?
Well, I don't know about over and above the call of duty, but I remember working in a political situation and finding myself in whistleblower straits where I was fired for not doing something I considered to be unethical. And that stayed with me and caused me to, I'm a lawyer and work in labor law, and I began to see the strategic benefit of whistleblowers. And I used to be the policy director of a group called the Government Accountability Project, which is a whistleblower law firm.
Right.
And it was like working in a legal MASH unit because you'd get calls from Veterans Affairs, from corporations, from state and local government, and they were kind of emergency calls, like, I just reported something, I've been fired, help put me back together again. And it was like practicing emergency room law. And one of the clients they represented was a group of Forest Service employees who had banded together collectively and were using the organization as a way to help reform the agency from the inside. And working as the lawyer with those people, I was struck that you had the opportunity to practice what I call preventative law. So that you weren't always fighting inside somebody's personnel jacket. You were delivering the message, in many cases, divorced from the messenger to the agency. And when the agency isn't allowed to change the subject and has to respond to the issue and not blame it on a particular disgruntled employee, you've already won half the battle. It's the terrain you want to be on. And so the effort was made to extend this beyond the Forest Service and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which creates a mercifully pronounceable acronym, PEER, was born. But it's also sort of a double entendre in that not only are we looking into the agencies, but also is to convey to staff that they're equal, that they have a place at the table. We often joke that in many of these public agencies, staff is spelled with a PH as if they're a lower-level life form. And in essence, they're really the experts, and there are about 250,000 environmental specialists working in the United States, many of whom don't think that they are able to do their job and serve the public as well as they could, and we're the vehicle by which they better serve you, or as we say, we defend those who defend the environment.
There's so many examples out there. The imagination almost pales. We find ourselves
business
in a dubious situation. I'm sorry, sir?
Business is brisk.
Yeah, it's a growth industry. You know, we find ourselves in a situation where while the statute seems to suggest that there are more protections for whistleblowers, everywhere we look, we see whistleblowers being prosecuted to the 49th degree. How do you make sense of this?
Well, there's often a disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality, and that's been more true of the Obama administration than we expected. So there's
gently
a lot
put,
of sort
sir.
Of lofty things, but then in terms of what happens in the trenches, not much has changed except there's kind of a deeper level of hypocrisy around it. So blowing the whistle, publicly blowing the whistle, is never a career-advancing move. And also, I can't think of an example, certainly in this administration, where somebody who blew the whistle on something, somebody who took a career risk to try and solve a problem, never is then put in charge of that program to basically vindicate what they started. And in many cases, they're the ones that are most qualified to turn these agencies around. They're universally pariahs, which is why, while we do whistleblower defense, we try and avoid having people be in those situations. I call it talking down jumpers, and it's one of the best things we do. Instead, we try and work with employees to figure out a way to deliver, as I said, the message without the messenger, and symbolic of the way we operate. The only product we sell are boxer shorts that say undercover activist on the butt and our logo on the leg so you can safely wear them to work.
That's funny.
And so the best, most effective activists are ones that are not known by the agency. In many cases, they're the ones that are in charge of designing the damage control to their own charges. And it's also one of the reasons we do an awful lot of Freedom of Information Act work, including a lot of FOIA litigation, because as an alternative to somebody coming forward with the documents, they instead just point us to the documents, and we go get them. And we then engage in a public fight with their agency to deliver what are now secret documents, and it's a battle that a lot of reporters can understand because they have similar frustrations, and when the documents finally are revealed, you've effectively put pressure on the agency to address what the documents show, but it's done in a way in which the true source is on the seabed while the battle takes place on the surface of the ocean.
Sure. That's assuming you can actually get at the information. I know
but
in my...
That's
in
why
my...
we sue a lot. We filed a Freedom of Information Act suit once every 3 weeks.
Luckily, we have a transparent administration who supports whistleblowers now, so your work must be so much easier. You know, we are faced with so many rather curious dilemmas environmentally right now. We've got this decision on the pipeline issue. You know, here in an open and free society where truth and openness is valued, we find ourselves in a situation where when there's an oil spill in Arkansas, the FAA declares it a no-fly zone so that reporters can't monitor what's going on, that the press is stopped from even walking the shoreline on the Gulf of Mexico. You know, do you...
In some part, those operations are run by the corporations that caused them. So we're working right now with one of the most obscure, important agencies called the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA.
Boy, I bet they're the ones funded.
Well, and they're the ones that are supposed to be in charge of the network of pipelines that would, in the U.S., the network would wrap around the circumference of the Earth 25 times and could take us close to the sun. But for the most part, it's a sleepy little agency that's industry-dominated, and when there is a major incident, for the most part, the response is to get out of the way, to let the corporation solve it with almost no public oversight.
I won't ask you to talk about any of your current cases, but could you talk about one that was successfully resolved, maybe?
Sure. On the personnel side, we just got, I think, the largest publicly known settlement in a whistleblower case out of OSHA. The person who was their record-keeping expert was fired after he testified about how the system didn't work. On the individual level, in terms of kind of reforms, things like the lead paint repair and renovation rules were a result of whistleblowers inside EPA that pointed out that the agency had basically sat on their hands for a decade and not implemented the rules that addressed the last major pathway of exposure to American youth. An estimated 1.4 million kids in the country are exposed to lead dust in perilous levels due to faulty repairs and renovation. So armed with that insight, we were able to sue the agency and force them to finally act on the regulations which are now in place.
You know, in an era of sequester and deregulation, I think there's probably little for a consumer to assume except that they're under greater risk every day and that the regulators aren't the foxes guarding the chicken coop.
Well, the situation is certainly uneven, not only from agency to agency, but also even within the same agency from appointee to appointee. So there's no quality control is not the strong suit here.
Just let me tell you one very short little anecdote in my own experience. There was a citizen scientific project that the state of Florida offered. If you were a citizen scientist and you wanted to contribute, you could do collect water samples and do filtration exercises in local lakes and estuaries and waterways. And I was participating in this. I have a background in the sciences, you know, biochemistry and biophysics. And so I was turning in these samples religiously every month for about 2 years. And I asked the lake limnologist who was in charge of it in our area. I said, so let me ask you, you know, I think it's wonderful, and I'm a big fan of science data collection because without the data, you can't draw any conclusions. Otherwise, you're just blue skying it. But I was wondering, you know, are these records going anywhere? And he said, well, you know, as a matter of fact, they are, because, well, I could give you an example. He said, one of the waterways right near a large landfill, there's a science student who's been taking samples there, and he was able to test it, and he's shown that the ammonia level now, of course, this is a perfectly safe landfill, the county will assure you. It's lined, and there's no leakage, but a canal immediately south of this landfill, which leads right into the National Park, Biscayne Bay, had ammonia levels in it 2,000 times the legal limit. And he said, see, so things are happening. And I said, well, let me ask you this. You're the water scientist. Have you reported this to anybody, or is it just going to be a science experiment at a local science fair? He said, do you really think I should, do you think I should, you know, report it? Who would I report it to? Now, this is the state limnologist who's responsible for this study. I said, well, you could call Solid Waste and let them know that they're landfill is leaking. You could call the EPA and say that there's a pollution source going into the national park. You could call the national park. You could call the State Department of Environmental Regulation. You can call any of these people. And he goes, you really think I should? And I said, well, you're in the unique position of actually having the information. If the information doesn't go anywhere, then it's not doing any good. He said, well, tell you what, I'll tell somebody, and I won't tell them that you told me to. And I thought, how curious is that? His first reaction is, A, I have no idea who to turn into, and then B, he'll protect me. And I thought that was illustrative of, you know, what passes for common science nowadays.
Florida is particularly challenging. As we've discussed, we have a Florida chapter out of Tallahassee run by a former enforcement attorney in the DEP named Jerry Phillips. And you can find his information on our website, which is peer.org. And he could tell you stories on that same subject of how the state has purged its own laboratories
right,
to make
right.
sure that certain results are not reported to anybody.
Right.
And so Florida is a state in which basic math is dangerous. So we're deeply respectful of the challenges down there, and there is so much at stake. So it's one of the great ironies.
I was producing a TV show on sports fishing. It's very popular on this part of the coast. And I asked a local wildlife officer, I said, so tell me, who's the state biologist in charge of water chemistry? He said, listen, you'll never get him on the show. And I said, why is that? And he said, they don't ever let him out of the labs. He never does any public statements. And I said, well, I can imagine why. So when I did track him down and got him to agree to an interview, the host and hostess of my show said they would never appear on a show where a water chemist was involved, because they knew intuitively that since the county had just declared one of our local waterways so polluted that you shouldn't even touch it, that he might raise questions about the safety of food taken from the sea. And he made a statement on air that the only fish that he thought were safe to eat were dolphins, because for some reason they don't bioaccumulate mercury. They weren't sure why, but that was the only sports fish that didn't accumulate mercury. Everything else, he said, was inedible as far as he was concerned, fresh and salt. And I thought, my goodness, you know, if this was known, one of two things would happen. Either, of course, they'd discredit the guy and drive him out of town, or maybe we could do something about the point sources of mercury pollution. But it's a very difficult state to work in when you're talking about quality. Whenever they have a public official who's performing very well, he's typically replaced with somebody who'll not quite do so much good. Let me ask you another question.
And I was going to just interject that one of the motifs that transcends Florida is the Roberts Supreme Court in Samuel Alito's first swing decision ruled that government employees at all levels have no First Amendment rights when they're within the scope of duty, and the rationale is that the government owns their speech. And so the sort of mistaken notion that people that work for you, in essence the public, have First Amendment rights is no longer true, and has not been true for now almost close to a decade. This decision was in 2006. And it's one of the reasons that mechanisms like our organization become even more important, because in order for these public servants to communicate with their true employers, you, they have to step outside of their role as government employees, and in many instances they need some help doing that.
Wow. That's I'm very rarely surprised on these matters, and I had not heard that or put it in that context. My God, that's terrible.
It's challenging. And it's especially difficult for scientists, because the only remaining legal protection for them are whistleblower statutes, and a lot of times scientists who are reporting that studies are suppressed, or that a methodology was skewed, or that a key finding was taken out, aren't reporting a violation of law, rule, regulation, gross waste or mismanagement, or imminent danger to public health. They're reporting faulty science, and generally speaking, and it's often said, you're entitled to your own opinion but not your own set of facts. That's not true in government. In government,
you're not allowed to create
your own set of facts. There's no rule, for the most part, against it. To some extent, that's changing at the federal level, but if you're following our website, you'll see that those changes are slow and uneven.
Well, you know, we've had some interesting decisions with the increased radiation on the West Coast. We have upped our local radiation safety level. You can have more radiation now since there's more radiation. And I understand that fracking water has just been approved for drinking. So that's another interesting aspect.
Well, sort of yes and no. On the fracking water, and that is one of our cases, the chemicals that are introduced into these drilling shafts in the East no one knows what they are. In the East, they're not supposed to be discharged to the surface. They're supposed to be segregated and stored, which creates its own set of problems. In the West, since 1979, what's called produced water is allowed to be pumped out onto the surface. And the idea was it's arid out there, the water, it's just underground water, there's no problem with it, and it's important for livestock and wildlife. And what's happened in recent years is that the produced water is now supplemented by an array of added chemicals. And so we got involved on discharge permits in an Indian reservation in Wyoming, where EPA, in essence, was allowing the fracking and maintenance fluids, all of which are highly toxic, to be discharged, despite a lot of evidence that animals that drink it in any kind of quantity die or are rendered sterile or in some way are harmed. And so we're trying to, in essence, fight for the soul of EPA on this issue, and we know internally there's an awful lot of disagreement, and the fact that the permit didn't mention this was a function of an internal fight where EPA, while some Republicans characterize it as an out-of-control regulator, on issues like fracking is afraid of its own shadow. And we're trying to excise the issue so it wouldn't be discussed and there wouldn't be controversy.
I don't know. Have you seen the film Fracking 2.0?
No.
One of the pieces that was aired in there, they were saying that while the local EPA scientists that were working on the Pavilion, Wyoming project could not formally say that the water was unsafe, that these people were living in areas where it was unsafe to live because of the gases being the gases leaking to the surface, but they said off the record to these people, "My God, get out of here! Don't drink the water; it's terrible." This privatization of the truth, this outlawing of any released information because of we have to protect the delicate sensibilities of Republicans, this seems to me to be the trend of the time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Bush years were challenging in their own way. There's sort of – it's a different configuration, though some of the patterns remain the same. And we were surprised because we thought this administration was going to be different, and it is different, but not in the ways that we had expected and hoped.
Right. Well, I absolutely have to applaud your optimism and the good work that you're doing to protect whistleblowers. Number one, why don't you tell our audience how they can get in touch with you, how they can support the organization peer.org. Are there ways that the public can help?
Sure. If you go to peer.org, you'll find an array of information that's divided by state and agency, as well as opportunities to contribute, buy underwear, pick up kits of information that can help individual employees see the whistleblower law in your state, look at all the scientific integrity policies, basically everything you'd want to know about this subject and things you've never heard of that are coming out of these agencies are available at peer.org.
Well, sir, thank you so very much for joining us. I will definitely be calling your Florida office to get them to come on the show. This is such critical information, and we are so much we owe organizations like yours so very much to try to keep the truth alive, to try to get it through those who would stifle inconvenient or non-commercially valid truth. Thank
you, sir. Well, thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, ladies and gentlemen, that was the executive director, Mr. Rooks of PEER. That is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again when Progressive News Network presents the Word of the Activists. You'll hear a lot of a lot of news stories in other places. But our goal is to bring the voice of the activists, the people actually working on making this a better world, to you so that you can see that there is good work going on. There are good people doing good things to preserve us from those who would trash and burn the planet and destroy completely the way we live here on planet Earth. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in.
Call me green or blue or red.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I sure know, mister, my hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No different in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free.